Conference record has joined the conference.
Capture. So let me kind of go around and just ask if there are other policy issues that we have missed that you want to be sure that we tackle. Melanie.
Please. Sorry, you're so good at that. Thank God she turns it on for me every time. I just want to underline what Jim from Mathematica, whose last name I can't pronounce, said about the essential need for stakeholder involvement. And I would also underline, not just in the planning, and I know Marilyn mentioned the idea of having further stakeholder input upstate and downstate. I would second that. But I also would say that stakeholder involvement, and by that I mean people with disabilities and seniors, in the implementation of whatever happens going forward and in the governance of plans as well.
Okay. Joanne.
What's really important, and I think you kind of went back to it, is I think there's more than just models that we need to be looking at. So some of the questions about what's the benefit package, what's the payment package, to me, could and should be modified depending on what the model is. So I think we have to be willing to look at it by model and what would be the components within that model and what would be the payment mechanism to best support that model. The other thing that I think you addressed, although I would maybe come at it maybe a little bit differently, where there's almost an implied what's the future of existing care coordination models, I would come at it slightly different. What do we need out of the existing care coordination models to change in order to meet our expectations? So this sounds like we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I'd rather keep the baby and figure how we allow it to develop and grow potentially into that next adulthood stage. So I'd really come at it slightly differently from what I think. And that may be particularly, I think, you know, I have this upstate, downstate concern, and I think that may be particularly relevant as you look to build on what we've already had in this structure, particularly upstate, and take them to the next generation.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mark.
What I think also needs to be addressed is the challenges when you have Medicare and Medicaid. There's somehow that the federal piece has got to be at the table when you're talking about long-term care. From a consumer standpoint, from a provider standpoint, from a seamless standpoint, oftentimes benefit designs or deliveries of care are driven by what payer is going to do it and how do we maximize it. The state does it, the providers do it, plans do it. Somehow that Medicare, Medicaid somehow needs to be thought of as holistic as opposed to what's the best avenue to get the service and how is it going to get paid for it. Oftentimes things are driven based upon who is the payer, Medicare or Medicaid. And can there be a system of care that addresses the needs of the person as opposed to which benefit and what is the limitations of that benefit and how do we maximize Medicare or Medicaid?
Mark, it's Eli. I think that, you know, we see coordinated care, at least in the long-term care setting, as a bridge toward ultimately a fully integrated program. So as was presented, we see this as step one before step two. There exist MAP programs that are out there right now. I think that the question the state may have is if there are savings that are to be garnered on the Medicare side at this point, to what extent does the state get credit for those savings so that they can apply it against what they're doing to better maximize that activity. But I think that's all part and parcel of where we're headed with it in any event. The current long-term care integration component for coordinated care is a bridge, as I would see it, toward the next 3 to 5 years in terms of where this is going to go. Kathy?
I have a couple of questions. One that is policy, and one is more administrative. On the policy side, I'm just wondering how this expansion of managed long-term care and the mandatory part of it intersects with the state's health home initiative, and if they are going to be merged at some point or if it's one and the same thing. And the second question, and actually it's both policy administrative, is you know, so now you have statutory authority to go up to 75 managed long-term care plans. So my question is, one, you know, how in the world is the health department going to do that administratively, because it can take over a year to get one plan up and running. And then the second piece is, if this is a bridge and at some point it's going to be more integrated, why develop another 50 partial plans if in a couple of years you're going to be someplace else?
I am going to instantly turn this off. I have to say, we did discuss the health home issue ourselves yesterday.
Yeah,
right?
That's a great question. I mean, the health home initiative is part of the budget this year. It's time limited to 8 quarters to get the enhanced federal reimbursement, so there was a big drive to get that 90% reimbursement. So there are intersections and complementary initiatives, and we are working within the health department to try to make sure that we are complementing each other and intersecting our approach. There's not really, I mean, a managed long-term care approach and a health home approach can be the same thing and philosophically, and it can be something different. So it's not an answer that, is very clear. I'm being really unclear. I realize that. But it's not an answer that has a lot of clarity at this point. The key in the budget was to get the 90% reimbursement as a way to avoid, you know, additional Medicaid reduction. So there's a state plan amendment that went in, and we're working with CMS on that, and it'll have to all work itself out at some point. And on the administrative side, you know, that is a challenge, and I'm not going to be, shy about it. It's definitely a challenge. We're up for the challenge, I think, but it is going to require a reorganization of the health department and the way they're organized in order to do this, and that's undergoing. We're undergoing that at this point. You know, a lot of plans are starting to be made, and to do that, and it's going to be a challenge to really get the 75 plan. If we do have in fact 75 plans up and running, that's going to be a challenge to get them up and running, and then all the things that come at the back end of that. Someone said earlier, you know, we have to worry about the back end too, monitoring the plan. We're going to ensure that the services are delivered. And we have a lot of experience on the mainstream side, but on the managed long-term care side, we're going to have to reorganize and make ourselves up to that challenge.
Hey, I don't know, Kim, if you want to add anything.
Yeah. It's sort of an understatement to say there's a lot of complexity in all of this. I think we have to keep reminding ourselves that a lot of this stuff just hangs together, and just we can't pick out a particular piece of it and look at it in isolation. And it's also very worthwhile to remember how and why we got here. The motivation for the comprehensive Medicaid redesign team recommendations was to find a rational approach to a looming budget deficit in which significant Medicaid cuts were going to be necessary, and we were obviously looking for a path to reduce expenditures that did not involve loss of benefits, loss of eligibility, or deterioration of quality. So what resulted was a very much comprehensive package with a lot of pieces that were related to everything else. The move to managed care was integral to that overall package. I think, you know, why do it now and why wait? I think one of the implicit policy objectives in the set of recommendations that was made was implicit in those recommendations was that there was a recognized desirability of provider-based managed care, rather than the traditional insurance-type plans. I think there is a concern that if we don't begin to develop those provider capabilities now, put the training wheels on, at this stage when we're really not facing the dual problem, and we're not going to be ready when the forces for integration really take hold. We have a lot of the providers in the state. As Jim said, we have a good foundation with managed long-term care plan, with the PACE plan. Many providers have made the transition and are able to manage risk and work in this environment. I think we've got to do a lot more to get the provider community to that situation if they're ever going to be a hope that they're going to be able to manage the Medicare piece of this as well as the Medicaid piece. So I think it would be, I think it's a good idea to go first with Medicaid and then be able to transition into the Medicare rather than waiting for that.
Now, I do want to underscore something that Jim said, which is I think the number of providers who, remember, provided patient care and did not have any of the attributes of a typical insurance company have been able to make the transition and have learned how to manage risk. So I think that's heartening, and I think that is part of the foundation that we have here. But there is a maturation process that comes with learning how to take risk and putting in the infrastructure, and I think we have to kind of phase that in. The other thing, and I think Mark and Valencia are aware, like we have been talking to Greg Allen about health homes and long-term care and how health homes might have to be different for a long-term care population, and trying to also capture what those differences might have to be. I mean, I'm not sure myself how it's all going to come together, but I think there is an awareness that it may be different for that population.
Just one other comment. I think there's a caveat, even on the provider side, that in looking at the future in terms of managing care, whether it be only long-term care or whether we're managing an integrated product, that from a provider standpoint, it's not the fill beds, it's not the substitute and be able to pay for something that is going to be lost on the other end. I think we're looking at a whole change in philosophy and what drives need versus outcome against the need. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to spend a lot of money at a need to go ahead and get that result that you're looking for. So, you know, I think we need to keep it in mind that there's a balance between cost and outcome. And one has to look at it based on clinical needs that the individual has to have. So,
okay, so let's now go back to our sort of policy agenda. Joe?
A couple of comments, just one in follow-up to Eli's comment. One of the things that I think is a defining feature of provider organizations that are also the managed care plans is the incentives, if you will, are aligned. If you can keep someone safe, healthy, functional, in their community, that's good for them. And so provider insurers have every incentive to do that because it's best for the member and it's also best for the viability of the organization. Then to a policy issue I wanted to raise, but I think it's a little bit different plan on a lot of the items that are listed here. This is a phenomenal list of questions that are issues. I think it's great and pretty comprehensive list. One, building on the discussion of this morning, I think most of us, maybe all of us, agree on the importance of continuity of services for these folks and continuing to meet the needs that the variety of programs have been meeting. And so I think one of our policy issues going forward has to be how do we maximize the percentage of the dollar that we have to spend, maximize that percentage going to the care and services that the people we're trying to serve need, which means looking at regulatory and operational infrastructure that has developed over the years around each of the different programs. The programs are there because they were designed to meet a particular need at a particular point in time, and they evolved over time. There are operational processes, regulatory structures, et cetera. And as we go forward and morph some things beyond where they are now, we need to be very careful to, at some point, take an explicit step back and figure out what we can strip out, where not we need appropriate oversight. I'm not questioning that at all. But we also need to make sure that we just don't leave things there because they have been there.
I think that's something we hadn't thought about. Just having read, I don't know how many other people saw the Commonwealth study on percentage of dollars that goes to administration and managed care plans. And I think it was 6% for Medicaid, 14% for Medicare Advantage on average. But I think we do have to look at how, you know, the classic, how much actually goes to services versus how much goes to administration. So thank you for raising that.
Sure.
Dave.
David McNally, ARP. Two quick housekeeping. One is thanks to some awesome ARP interns. There are copies of the slides over here on the window.
That is very good customer service. Thank you, Dave. Right.
And the other thing I wanted to say was throughout the day we've heard a lot of, you know, I don't know. We don't know that yet. And I'm wondering if we could kind of create a parking lot of the questions we don't have answers to so we can remember they need to be answered, so particularly when it comes to the processes and the timetables and how consumers are going to have their chance. And those are the pieces that I know that a lot of this is we're making it up as we go, kind of because of the time constraints and the fiscal constraints, particularly with the budget this spring. But if we can keep a list of things we don't know, we'll remember that we need to know them as we go forward. And the one policy piece I wanted to ask about, ARP is kind of is a unique organization in many ways, but, you know, we have a lot of beneficiaries, obviously, but we also have a lot of caregivers. Our population is, of course, 50-plus, and I guess I want to ask how or will the role and the needs and the services of the caregiver figure into the development of these kind of coordinated plans? I mean, the caregivers, I think SOFA in 2007 said caregiving was worth about $25 billion in the state, and, you know, it wouldn't take too many caregivers to give up the ghost and move somebody into more expensive care for us. If you think the Medicaid budget's a problem now, wait till some of those caregivers don't get the support they need and end up filling the bed fast. So I would throw out there a pitch to consider the need of the caregiver in this effort.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Marilyn.
A couple of comments, and it's kind of all over the place about things that will be listed here. If you look at enrollment, I think that people come in, or we have people now in plans who all have all kinds of different needs, all kinds of different lifestyles, medical conditions, whatever, and that's going to go off the radar. It's going to hit the top when we get more people coming into the plan. And I think that what plans have to show competency, so that if you're a plan like Choice, you have great competency in dealing with frail elderly, people who have dementia, and families, and the relationship with that. ILMED has an expertise in working with people with visual impairments. ICS, for physical disabilities, so that when you talk about open enrollment and auto enrollment, these people coming into the system are not going to have a clue what they need because they've never experienced it before. And it's on us to make sure that people are directed to plan that has competency in dealing with their particular condition. I mean, if your mother becomes ill, breaks her hip, has a heart attack, and you have to get her home care, and you have to get other services, well, how do they know where to go? And auto enrollment doesn't solve that. So we have to look at that. What was said about the workers, there is a huge problem with parity of pay for home care workers. There's a discrepancy with what a home health day gets and what a PCA gets. There's also issues that deal with, right now in fee-for-service, providers, private agencies are paid about $17 an hour. Managed cares aren't reimbursed at that rate to continue doing that. In New York City, we have this Family Living Wage Act, which is great, but not all the plans, you know, there. If you look at how the plans pay different providers, and if you look at how the licensing fees pay their workers, it's huge discrepancy. And you're going to have people who are licensed agencies are closing, who charge, they who then have to get contracts with managed or term care. Well, what is the state going to do to to enforce the fact that people have to be paid a decent working wage, which is more in New York City, and that they have to be able to plants have to be reimbursed at the level that fees and services, so that at least in New York City we could continue to do that. It's a workers' issue. It's a really, really huge. In terms of the rights of consumers in our program, Mark was really heard a lot from the community about prevention of rights. I don't know how many of you have seen what self-help wrote and what legal services did about the rights that should be guaranteed for consumers, no matter what age they are, in managed long-term care. So how do we, we can come up with all these great ideas and suggestions, but who is going to be enforcing this? I mean, Maximus is going to be doing enrollment. What does Maximus know about what the different plans offer? What do people who are going to be in HRA can't, talk about specific plans? They have to talk about plans. So how do you help direct someone to the right program? And, they were talking about parity as far as different plans providing the same thing. I was at a meeting about a year and a half ago. Mary, you were there. Mary had set up a meeting with HRA, with the supervisors and the COPSIS, and the opportunity of having the plan in New York City come in and talk about what we offered, what we were different. And we were the last plan to go. And the majority of plans, when they were asked questions by the CASA worker, the one question they asked repeatedly was, you provide 24-hour care. And with the exception of Choice, and I may forget some, with the exception of Gilmet and ourselves, I can't say who did it. I can say that five plans in that room said, we consider anyone with 12 hours of care unpaid in the community. We don't take them.
I think, Marilyn, you're capturing something that a few people said earlier. I think Alan made the point, and several others have. And it's, how are we going to transition the system? Patrick, when he gave us the data, said there were, 11 to 12% of people who had 12 or more hours of care. And I think that's going to be a transition and operational issue that we're going to have to tackle. I think the issue around the workforce and parity is going to be another large transitional issue that also involves continuity. So I see some of these as very substantial operational and transitional issues that, how do you get from here to there? Even if, we agree on the destination, we're still going to have to figure out what are the phases and steps we have to go through. And in this particular arena, as we all know, workers are very, very important. The capacity of the system very much relies on the competencies and dedication of the workers. Melanie, you've had your hand up for a while, right?
Yes. We've talked a little bit about this, but I just wanted to put it on the table as something that we need to look directly at, and that is protecting the folks with very high needs, most at risk for institutionalization, both in terms of their procedural rights, the right to live in the community in the most integrated setting. And, of course, that carries over to the issues with the plans and the rates. How are we going to protect them so that they're able to serve these folks in the community where they choose and can be 12 hours or not, which that was pretty shocking, Marilyn. And the other thing I just wanted to throw out in terms of implementation is another provision in the health reform law that the governor has committed to implementing, and that's the community first choice option. And this would be another way to get an increased FMAP. It would be a way to look at people in terms of functional need, as we discussed, rather than diagnosis or age. And we would, very much like to hear how that's going to be integrated with the shift to managed care.
Okay. All right. On this side of the table, are there any other policy issues that anyone wants to raise? Alan?
Well, Melanie just started to raise one of them, and that's the protection of the plans. We're talking about the protection of the consumers, but if the plans don't survive, there's nobody to provide the service. A corollary to the 212, so the 12-hour thing, is the state's position on Olmstead and how the legal requirements of Olmstead can best be met. For example, in your first point, Carol, what long-term care service should be included? If nursing home benefit is an unlimited benefit without a cap, the cost to a plan is enormous because it's a nursing home plus everything else. So under Olmstead, can you take someone, for example, in a community setting, and at some point when the cost of care becomes prohibitive, say the cost could be a factor? As I read Olmstead, you can. You're shaking. And I'm sure the other lawyers in the room have different opinions, but cost can be a factor if it's going to fundamentally change the nature of the state's ability to provide service. I think that's almost a quote from Olmstead. So I think that becomes a necessary thing for us to consider. One of the other points down here talks about how we improve care, how we improve outcomes. No one seems to be focused on the metrics of how we're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a two-month or a three-month or a six-month task. Mark and his group have been doing that for a long time.
Right.
It's really, really important to get it right, because unless you get the metric right, everything else falls apart.
Right.
So I would ask that we focus a lot on looking at how that happens. The transition of care from the siloed systems we now have, CHAS, long-terms, or other things, into MLTC, each of those programs uses different assessment instruments. Each of them has their own motivations for, I don't describe bad motivations to anybody, but their own motivation for providing the services they provide. When the rights of the consumer bump up against a determination of medical necessity by a plan, that's different from what the consumer's been getting.
Mm-hmm.
How do we reconcile that?
Can you explain that? I didn't quite follow that.
It's fair hearing, right? It becomes an issue if somebody has been getting, Marilyn, any level of care, 12 hours, 24 hours, from a shop. Shops are now shedding their cases at a prodigious rate because of the cost constraints. When we're looking at the cases, and I'm speaking just to my plan, but I know I've spoken with folks at Carol's program and Eli's, when we're looking at the cases that we get that are coming from those programs, they don't need the level of care that they've been getting. If they have a fair hearing right up front to continue that care under care continuing until there's a hearing on the merits, the plan, number one, is disadvantaged financially, but perhaps even more importantly, maybe committing fraud in providing services reimbursed by Medicaid that the plan's own staff, own medical director, own nurses, have determined they don't need.
Well, then you're not committing fraud if you've determined that they don't need
No. We've determined they don't need it, but until the fair hearing is held on the merits, we have to give it.
But that's the legal protection that has been fought and is sacrosanct in the community.
Legal protection on whose side, though? It's a one-sided sword.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that at all.
I know you don't.
Okay. All right. Well, clearly we have surfaced a significant disagreement. Okay. Let me just make sure that there are no other policy issues that we have not addressed. Joe.
I think there's one, although, again, I think it connects with Joe Healy. Sorry. Connect a number of things. We've talked about maybe as many as 75 plans, and I understand the intent of that is to provide access and services, in especially in areas where there isn't access. And at the same time, we've talked about the fact that we need to sort of maximize the percentage of the premium that goes to services. And in fact, the planned reduction in administrative PMPM is predicated on organizations becoming large enough to achieve some efficiency. So the policy issue has to do with what's the the bridge that we've referenced from expansion to improve access and continuity of services. But then ultimately there will need to be consolidation to achieve the efficiency that we need to see so that we don't in fact build an inefficient system, even more inefficient than we have now, to provide the services that we need to provide that will generate at a minimum a lot of additional work on the part of the state, for sure.
That whole issue of scale in terms of financial viability, keeping your administrative costs down, making it manageable from a state point of view, I think is an important issue. Okay, on this side of the table, Kathy.
I would add to that. I think capacity doesn't really mean more plans. It means more capacity. It could be more plans, but it doesn't necessarily have to mean more plans.
Okay. Kevin, anything we have missed from your angle? All right. So now I think we're going to try to pull all of this together, summarize what all of you have said, and try to plot out the next steps and get that to you once we have the game plan and figure out what we think we need to do next. And so I think we will try to do that in the next, I would say, Mark, 2 to 3 weeks for sure. Eli, do you want to add anything?
No, I think it'd be interesting to see once we digest all of this. Whether or not there might be a further need to have a conference call or something before we have the meeting, if there's any clarification that's needed. But beyond that, I think we're focused very well.
So I just want to say that for those of you who are on the work group, if you have any further thoughts, if you chew on this, please feel free to reach out to Eli or me, to Mark or Valencia with any comments or questions that arise. And for those people who are on the phone or observers, we welcome you as well to use our website and to give us your observations or any presentations or information you think we should be aware of and as part of our deliberations. And I have not forgotten, Dave, your parking lot, that we do need to go and look at the process, and we will take a look at that as well. So I want to thank all of you. I hope we've at least begun to set the foundation and give you a framework for what exists now and try to at least delineate the questions we have to address in a short amount of time to complete our charge. So thanks again for your participation and engagement today. Okay. All right. We probably have to figure out.
on?
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.